Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history.
Those of you thinking about going to bed right now, I would strongly advise you to reconsider that, because I think that one of our first tasks for all of us here as well as you is to actually go out and make sense of what exactly the status of this document is, what the different blocks in the negotiations are actually saying, and where the formal UNFCCC process is.
Okay, it's 10 to 1. I'm going to try and timestamp my audio diaries throughout the next 24 hours or however long these negotiations continue, presuming they don't go on longer than Sunday when I've got a coach booked to return to London. And I've just finished filing today's programme and we'll try and give you an assessment of where I think things are currently. Scientifically, we've already heard from John Schellenhuber that really these negotiations aren't based in science. There's not enough cuts on the table on the first hand for these talks to work. Rich countries just aren't pledging deep enough cuts. The EU still have a maximum of 30% on the table, which is conditional on getting a binding deal, and 50% of that can be met from offsets bought from developing countries, which are not verifiable. It's a lot of those have proven to be not additional cuts. Between a third and two-thirds are estimated not to be real cuts at all. And also the EU could go much, much further, because the recession here has reduced the carbon emissions here by a substantial amount. The US is still sticking to its pathetic pledge and is committed to using the market measures that are outlined in the House of Representatives Act. That was shown quite clearly yesterday at a press briefing by Nancy Pelosi and a whole bunch of other senators that are part of the US negotiating team here. Obama could have come here, as we heard earlier, pledging to use the Clean Air Act to phase out coal in the US and therefore bring a scientifically consistent target to the table. The EU could have also done 40% without offsets if there had been the political will. We haven't seen that. That was based on a report from the Stockholm Environmental Institute, which we've been flagging up a couple of times throughout the Copenhagen Daily. Then the issue of money. There's very little money on the table still. There are a few cards that I think that rich countries have yet to play. Gordon Brown has been talking up the possibility of finally, after a long campaign by NGOs over many years, Gordon Brown seems to be running with the idea of a Tobin tax, which is a tax on speculative financial transactions, these kind of futures tradings and money trades that go on in the trading halls around the world. A tax on that could raise billions of pounds. Also, I understand that the EU and others are still considering a levy on emissions rights. So a tax could be issued by the UN on the emissions allowances that are given to countries when everybody finally agrees their reductions here, presuming that happens. That is a possibility. There's also a tax on bunker fuels, shipping and aviation, which would do two things. It would curb the activity in that sector, so there would be less shipping and aviation, which would reduce carbon emissions in that sector. And it would also generate a lot of funds that could be used as part of a global fund here for adaptation and low carbon development in poor countries. We're still looking for hundreds of billions of pounds a year. So those are cards that could still be played over the next 24 hours. If you remember, in 1997, there were some wild cards that came out of the bag right at the end. The clean development mechanism was dropped pretty much in the last few hours at Kyoto. Let's hope nothing quite that bad is sprung on the conference this time. We've also got the deforestation text, which we've seen is really very much in the balance. People actually have very low confidence that we're going to see something strong enough to actually work, and that might actually result in perverse incentives and lots of dangerous pro-logging activity, bad for indigenous peoples and other forest-dependent communities. And if red was brought into the carbon markets, that could be a huge offset opportunity for the rich nations, so they would delay further still their decarbonisation and lock themselves further still into high carbon activity for decades to come, which is precisely what we should not be doing at this point in time. As Frederica White has been reporting, we've seen pushes for carbon capture and storage in nuclear energy, plantations and biofuels to be included in the clean development mechanism, all potentially very bad ideas. So if we get a deal here, it could be an inadequate one, but it could also be worse than that. It could actually provide perverse incentives to lock ourselves into high carbon infrastructure and economies for decades to come, and provide a new market for corporations and a new speculative bubble in carbon finance. So the omens at this point aren't looking good. We haven't seen a move beyond politics as usual, which is what we need to do. What would moving beyond politics as usual mean? Well, we would need to recognise that we are in an emergency situation, and that therefore we need a wartime response, that the kind of dramatic action that we saw during wartime, where production in factories was transformed to products that were needed for the war at a remarkable pace. We would need to see recognition of ecological limits taking their priority over economic growth, and to recognise that after all, economic growth does not have any link to well-being, so therefore we can actually have a steady state economy that is actually better for our well-being. And in terms of the way this conference is going to play out over the next 24 hours, that we need to go beyond politics as usual would mean to go beyond this idea of horse trading, where people accept somebody else's bad idea so that they can get their own bad idea through. This is not the way to conduct a successful climate deal. So we'll be updating you throughout the day. Frederica and myself, Phil England, will be here at the Bella Centre trying to follow the twists and turns of the negotiations. So more as it happens.
These international discussions have essentially taken place now for almost two decades. And we have very little to show for it, other than an increase, acceleration, of the climate change phenomena. The time for talk is over. This is the bottom line. We can embrace this accord, take a substantial step forward, continue to refine it, and build upon its foundation. We can do that, and everyone who is in this room will be part of a historic endeavor, one that makes life better for our children and our grandchildren. Or we can choose delay, falling back into the same divisions that have stood in the way of action for years. And we will be back having the same stale arguments month after month, year after year, perhaps decade after decade, all while the danger of climate change grows until it is irreversible. Ladies and gentlemen, there's no time to waste. America's made our choice. We have charted our course. We have made our commitments. We will do what we say. Now I believe it's the time for the nations and the people of the world to come together behind a common purpose. We are ready to get this done today. But there has to be movement on all sides to recognize that it is better for us to act than to talk. It's better for us to choose action over inaction. the future over the past. And with courage and faith, I believe that we can meet our responsibilities to our people and the future of our planet.
So I'm here with Jess Worth from New Internationalist magazine. And I know you've just seen Obama's speech, but perhaps you can give a reaction to that and also to how the talks have been going generally over the last couple of weeks.
I think I and a lot of people here have reacted with fury to Obama's speech. Essentially what he was saying was, this is the deal that's on the table. I'm the president of the US. You have to sign it, whether you like it or not. And all of you countries who are getting in the way and blocking things, stop it. This is all you're going to get. And that's completely outrageous because the deal that's on the table is terrible. It looks like, in terms of emissions reductions, it's extremely weak. So if this was the deal that the world goes with, we'd be looking at 3°C temperature rise. That means essentially wiping out a whole load of small islands and huge, devastating, runaway climate change. You know, we're talking about millions of people losing their lives here. And I can't believe that they can't summon up enough political will to break through this deadlock. And even when you look kind of beneath the headlines of the deal, it's riven with loopholes, it's riven with problems. Carbon trading is a central mechanism for delivering these emissions reductions. Now, we know that that doesn't work. What it essentially allows is industrialized countries to continue emitting, to continue business as usual, and offsetting those emissions reductions by buying credits from the developing world. So they're basically avoiding responsibility for the problem that they've caused. If you look at the deal on forests, it's been dramatically weakened in the last couple of days. So what was looking quite a hopeful way of bringing forests into the global climate regime, and essentially paying countries that depend on deforestation for income instead to preserve their forests. But what they've done is they've added, again, all kinds of loopholes that allow countries to cut down forests in the name of forest management and still gain credit for it, to count monocultures that don't have anything like the ecological value and carbon sink value of ancient forests as forests and to get credits for those. So that's hugely disappointing. The financing deal that Hillary Clinton sort of swept in and announced yesterday, it's kind of like adding insult to injury, really, for developing countries, because we don't know how much of that money is going to come directly from governments, but there's no obligation for any of it to. Again, a lot of it is probably going to come from the carbon market. So again, that's rich countries evading their responsibility. But also a really important role for the IMF and the World Bank, which, as we know, have essentially screwed over developing countries in terms of the strings that they attach to any kind of loan. And we don't know whether this $100 billion package from Clinton is actually going to be loans anyway. We don't know if it's real money. We don't know if it's additional to aid budgets. So I think all in all, we're looking at a total disaster here. And what I'm really hoping is that developing countries, particularly the least developed countries, the Africa bloc, that are coming under immense pressure, you know, all kinds of bullying and arm-twisting tactics we're hearing about going on behind the scenes, just hope they can withstand that. And they can stand up and say, no, we're not going to sign a deal that is essentially going to consign our populations to suffering and death in the future. We're going to hold firm and we're going to hold out until we get a deal that actually works. So the atmosphere in here is just really crazy at the moment. Everybody's running around. I just spoke to someone from the Indigenous Caucus, and he said it feels like the last few hours on the Titanic, when everyone's just running around shooting each other and stealing each other's money. So it's hard to say at this point whether the talks are going to collapse or whether Obama is going to manage to ram through this accord that he's talking about. But whatever happens, it won't be legally binding. It won't actually be enough to stop climate change. And I really think the only way to break through the bullshit that we're seeing around here is for social movements to rise up and not allow their politicians to get away with this. So I think, you know, the ball is back in the court of NGOs, civil society organisations that have been barred from these talks now, to get out there, to protest, to mobilise people, to take back control of our future.
The small island states in low and least developing countries, for example, say 1.5%, what they are saying, which is legitimate, that actually we are already seeing impact and the most we can cope with is 1.5, and also the science has to be revised. The IPCC's last report, since it was released, clearly there are been acceleration of global warming, which President Obama himself mentioned, to a level that actually I would say history will judge that actually the ambition that we should have had was closer to 1.5. And basically, when we say time is running out, what we mean is that the impacts are here and they're going to accelerate. And what we need to do is prevent it just exploding and being catastrophic. Because the implications are already, if I can give you one example, just to make the point about security, right? Darfur, the genocide in Darfur, people always talk about it simply as a ethnic conflict. But Lake Chad, which neighbors Darfur, was one of the largest inland seas in the world. That has virtually shrunk up. If you see Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, it's actually referenced as one of the examples. And water and land scarcity has been the biggest driver of the genocide in, of course, I'm not saying the other issues are not being manipulated, but water scarcity in particular. Sadly, people have to get with this analysis that future wars, probably, if we don't get this right, will not be fought about oil. Future wars are likely to be fought
We're working for a high ambition deal, and we continue to work for a high ambition deal. And if we can move to 20 to 30, we want to. At the moment, we are trying to ensure that these talks do keep going, because we think that a lot has been done over the last year. We have huge expectations rightly on our shoulders, and it is very important that we leave no stone unturned to try and make a success of these talks. Things don't look good at the moment, but we are trying our level best to get them back on track.
I'm here with Chris Henshaw of the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. John Vidal said that there are about 9 people in the world that understood what LULUCF was about. I'm hoping that Chris is one of those people. Can you tell me how big a loophole LULUCF represents for rich countries and how it works?
Sure, I think I am one of those 9 people, so you're in luck. Right now, the loophole is about the size of the entire Kyoto emission reduction commitment of industrialized countries, so about 5% of total 1990 emissions. It doesn't have to be a loophole. The loophole could be changed. And what we're really talking about is how countries account for emissions from forestry and other land uses.
Rich countries,
yeah. It's about developed countries that have Kyoto reduction commitments. So the question is, how do you account for these emissions? Like for every other sector, you have to track what your emissions are in transport or in the industrial sector, etc. And whether or not you're in compliance with your commitment depends on what those emissions are doing. The big problem with the current rules is that they're voluntary. So if a country doesn't want to account for emissions, it won't. And because it's voluntary, basically the only countries that are choosing to account for these emissions now are those who don't have emissions. Because the interesting thing about forests, of course, is in addition to releasing greenhouse gases when they're cut down, they also pull greenhouse gases out of the air when they grow. So it can actually be a benefit to countries. And it's only those countries that are benefiting that have chosen to account for it. So as I said, the size of the loophole is about equivalent to the current Kyoto emission reduction commitment. There's a second element of the loophole here with the current rules, and that is that countries can basically, instead of accounting for a change in the emissions that result from their management activities, they account for the total carbon flux in a commitment period. Now, what they can actually claim credit for is capped. So there's a limit on what they can claim credit for. But basically, they're claiming credit for stuff that they have no responsibility for and don't deserve credit for. So forests grow naturally. And if you're looking at the entire carbon flux in a commitment period, you can claim credits for forests growing naturally, irrespective of whether or not the sink is declining or increasing as a result of your management activity. So a country could actually take a forest that's a strong sink, double its harvest rate, its logging rate, decrease the size of that sink, and still claim credits. So that's those two things taken together, the voluntary nature in this, that's the loophole currently. Now, for a number of years, people have realized that this is a big loophole needed to be fixed. And we hoped that countries would come here planning to fix that. Instead, they came here planning to replace that loophole with a different one, which was about the same size. And the new loophole is we're going to start comparing our emissions in the commitment period to something else. So, you know, what's a measure of change rather than taking credit for everything? Except rather than doing what would make sense, which is compare the change in emissions from a historical level, they've said, well, we're actually going to project forward into the future what we think our emissions are going to be, and we'll measure ourselves against that. And there are three big problems with that. One is you can't verify a prediction of what you're going to do in the future. So there's quite a lot of opportunity for cheating there. The second is all of the countries that came forward doing this, and that's basically every developed country except for Switzerland and Norway and Russia, have said, well, actually, we plan on increasing our emissions, and we're not going to account for it. So it runs completely counter to what we're trying to do here. Countries saying we're going to increase our emissions in the forest sector and not account for it. So it's a very obvious loophole. That's, you know, in summary what the problem is, and what we've proposed a very simple and fair and objective solution, I think, which is account for actual changes in emissions. And the way we've prescribed this or proposed we do this is look at the entire period for which we have historical data. Countries have been submitting data on their forest emissions since 1990 till 2007 now. We have all that data. We've analyzed that data. We've put forward a proposal that countries would account for any change in emissions from the average of that data from 1990 to 2007. So it's very, very objective, would work for everyone, would close that loophole. The problem is countries don't like it because they don't get to increase their emissions anymore and don't get a free pass on those emissions. So, you know, things don't look great here right now in terms of getting a strong outcome in Copenhagen. It certainly looks like a lot of the work that's been done for the past 2 years on these, you know, detailed legal texts, you know, amendments to the Kyoto Protocol, we're not sure that that's actually going to get done here. The small silver lining might be that we don't cement this new loophole in the agreement, and maybe we can still fix it next year.
Okay. I mean, I understand that countries have been discussing this for at least a couple of years. This has been part of the excuse that rich countries have given about coming down with firm targets. What was in the most recent version of the text? It was the existing loopholes that you describe.
Yeah, in the current version of the text, basically they had the choice between loopholes, their choice of loopholes. There were two options in the text. One was the loophole we already have, and the other one was the new loophole we're trying to create. So either way, it would have been bad. You know, we were working right up to the end to try to get both those loopholes out and replace it with objective accounting. We didn't succeed here, but you know, there's really no conclusion on these negotiations here. So, you know, this issue may live to be won another day.
It remains to be seen if these talks get concluded. I understand right now. Also, there seems to be a lot of horse trading in the last section of negotiations like these. Do you have any tip-offs about trade-offs that people have been discussing?
Not really. I mean, the main thing, as you pointed out, is on this issue, developed countries were saying we need to get these rules done before we get to target. So I think, you know, a trade-off that was being considered is, okay, can we just give developed countries whatever they want so they'll start talking about targets so we can get the targets done. But, you know, the negotiations here seem to have been handled so poorly. You know, the Danish were broadcasting back in Barcelona already in November at the last set of talks that they were aiming for some kind of political declaration rather than, you know, an actual legal agreement based on the legal text that we've been negotiating for the past 2 years. So, you know, actually finalizing these issues has been undermined, I think, by the Danish presidency.
So it's been clear to the developing world countries, has it, that this is a loophole?
Oh, yeah. They know for sure it's a loophole. And, you know, I think the calculation that they've been doing all along is, you know, what's the value of closing this loophole versus calling the bluff of developed countries and getting them to put their targets on the table. You know, as it turns out, what's happened here is that whole discussion has been just replaced with this high-level political dialogue, which could result in something not very exciting. So we'll have to wait and see. I guess we'll know soon.
That's pretty much it for me, unless you've got any final thoughts you want to add?
I guess I'll just say that we're very keen on making forests count in this agreement in developed countries. We think if there's proper accounting, that it'll create the right incentives rather than, you know, putting the policy cart in front of the horse and assuming that things are good, like assuming bioenergy is good to use without actually accounting for the emissions from it. So we think if accounting is done properly, we'll see increased incentives to protect forests as well, because natural forests and older forests store more carbon.
Matilda Kalon Jurgensen from Civil Society's Climate Change Forum, speaking on behalf of the Klima Forum 09.
Dear delegates, we are speaking on behalf of the People's Climate Summit. While you, ladies and gentlemen, here in the Bella Forum, behind fences and far from ordinary people, so far have failed to deliver. More than 400 organizations representing millions of people from all corners of this planet have reached a deal, a people's declaration. We have managed to unite along common goals to address climate crisis, global injustices, and stressing real solutions for a just and sustainable future. You might say that these people have nothing at stake. They have everything at stake. They live with the daily threat of climate change. The negotiations within the COPs are not representing the people's voice, especially not the voice of indigenous people, women, and other vulnerable groups. We demand to be heard. We demand to be included in this process. We call for the UNFCCC to circulate this people's declaration as an official document submitted to the COP15.
I am Juan Rojas from El Salvador. I represent the oppressed and impoverished third world, and a lot of them are already dying from consequences of climate change. We call upon COP15 to reach an agreement that will initiate the restoration of Mother Earth and finally come up with a legally binding treaty with a specific emission reduction and an adequate long-term financing. We urge you to phase out fossil fuels within the 30 years and work out a carbon tax to give revenue for development of sustainable energy. We face a common threat to which we must react now. We cannot afford to wait until tomorrow. The solutions are among the people. Listen to them.
I thank you both for your powerful statements. Thank you very much.
So it's 22:11 here at night on Friday night, and it's been a busy day, far too much to keep up with, as always. Right now, the COP mop has been suspended, and Frederica's in the EU press conference, and there's also an Obama press briefing, but to the American press corps only, I believe. Basically, there's been a drafting group convened by the Danish president, and that was announced by the UNFCCC Executive Secretary Ivo de Boer. I've got a bit of audio for when he announced that, which you can hear now.
Distinguished delegates, as probably many of you are aware, the president of the COP and the CMP yesterday evening and throughout today has been holding high-level consultations with heads of state and government and other representatives of parties in a small setting. I must confess that I don't know exactly where those consultations stand, but I hope that the president can be here at 10 o'clock to brief you on those consultations to seek your views and on the basis of your recommendations decide how he wants to proceed. So I would recommend to you, Mr. Vice President, that perhaps we could, or you could decide to adjourn the session for an hour so everyone can have a break. Probably be back here at 10 o'clock, but please keep an eye on the monitors in case it's possible to come back earlier.
So it's 11:30 here. The EU press conference has been cancelled. A lot of journalists waiting around for nothing there for about an hour. Obama appears to have left the building. The secret deal that was being cooked up amongst 28 countries in the so-called Circle of Commitment has not been made public. Many developing countries apparently have not seen it yet. A number of journalists have, presumably leaked by country delegates. Just been to the documents desk, and it would appear that the Algerian paper, on behalf of the African group that I mentioned yesterday, is still on the table. 50 countries there supporting, as I said yesterday, the $400 billion a year request in kind of climate debt, if you like, adaptation and mitigation for poor countries into a UN fund from rich countries' public finances. And there's a package of four proposals which was handed on the documents desk with a cover sheet dated 18th of December. It looks to me like all these four texts are currently live, and yet everybody is running around as if the only text on the table was this cooked-up deal by 28 countries, the so-called Circle of Commitment, the rich countries, and a few people they managed to buy off, it would seem. The second text in this group of four texts is one by the Alliance of Small Island States, a group of 48 countries, from the 11th of December, that's last Thursday. Paper three is from Bolivia. I'm not sure who else is supporting that text. And paper four is from Peru. So I just think it's quite significant that the only text that people are interested in or focused on is the one put together by the industrialized countries and the major economies, as if there was no democratic process going on here at all. And there weren't other countries who had a stake in this deal and who were also at the negotiating table. I'm sure this is a subbing problem, but on the Guardian's Copenhagen Climate Summit website right now, it says live blog, Copenhagen Summit ends with feeble deal. Well, as far as I'm aware, there is no deal. As I say, there's a paper that a few people might have seen, which only 28 countries have agreed to, and nobody's talking about the other papers that are on the table. I just passed John Vidal a copy of the other texts that are on the table. He's put it to one side for the moment because I think he's writing a story, making an assessment of the Circle of Commitment text, which has just been dropped, and that is the story that they're working on currently.
Next, I'd like to pass the microphone to Antonio Hill from Oxfam.
Vulnerable developing countries here in Copenhagen came with the expectation that we would see a comprehensive agreement reached, and they've been put in an impossible position between looking at a hollow shell of an agreement for the last few days in a very untransparent process where not even negotiators, not even ministers in some cases, understand what's happening, what's actually in play, and what the deal is that they're looking at. The alternative, of course, always is to walk away or to accept that these negotiations do not conclude with any agreement. And neither of these is any option for vulnerable developing countries that have real needs.
We've heard many times in the last 12 days that no deal is preferable to a bad deal. Will you advise delegates to reject this, and if not, why not?
Antonio Hill from Oxfam. I think we need to recognize where we are in the process at this stage, which is midnight on the last night in Copenhagen that was scheduled for negotiations in Copenhagen. What we understand is the agreement that we're looking at has gone through many, many rounds. Today alone, there's been at least 5 or 6 different versions of this text. There has been a back and forth between countries. Clearly, countries are considering carefully that very question. I think there's no question that while, you know, whether or not a better agreement can be salvaged in Copenhagen, we do need a better agreement for the climate. And I think to the extent that it's possible to secure improvements this evening and into tomorrow with what's left of the negotiating time, where absolutely it needs to be improved. The agreement this draft that we're looking at now, that may or may not be agreed, also has behind it a whole series of more detailed pieces of the negotiation that have come out of the last 2 years. A lot of the attention over the last few days has rightly focused on the so-called crunch issues that have been taken up at the ministerial and head of state levels. Many of those are reflected in this piece of paper to the extent that there has been agreement. But what's going to be most important ultimately with an agreement is not just the headline numbers and whether or not they stack up, but the actual machinery behind it that is going to give us confidence that the numbers that are in there are not going to be like numbers in a G8 statement, a political declaration, but rather these are going to be undertaken in the context of international law as binding commitments, that they are going to be delivered, that institutional mechanisms and a global finance fund, for example, that's mentioned in this text, will be established in a way that's different to business as usual right now. A lot of that detail is still in text that we haven't seen. Negotiators are clearly privy to that. So I think, you know, we'll leave it to their best judgment, obviously. But what we can be clear about is that this needs to move as far as possible, as fast as possible, towards a fair, ambitious, and binding agreement, because anything less will be unacceptable for all.
Have you any idea about what had happened during those negotiations today?
Well, this is David Turnbull. I would say that, I mean, it's clear that the job isn't done yet, and we would certainly call on the leaders to come back to the table in the first half of the year to complete the deal, to complete the job, and to increase the level of ambition and the level of recognition of what is actually needed and what's required. In terms of the specifics on what's in the text, it's not over yet. We're not completed here, so, you know, we can see what happens, but I'll let Kim come in.
Well, just to say that that the negotiation process here has been such a mess that I think they simply ran out of time to be able to do it. I think I understand the agreement that those few who have entered this agreement, the understanding is that there will be figures put in for each individual country over a period in the coming months, and that they will do that, and there will be a longer period for small countries than for small poor countries than for the richer countries. So that will happen, I think. Point being, however, that these figures won't mean anything, because there's no definition of how you account for anything in this agreement. There's a definition that should account, but there's no definition how you're going to do it. That means that all of the loopholes that we have in existing agreements will be there, and no regulation of any of them. And that means that you can put in any figure, it won't mean nothing at all.
That's the sound of the floors in the television studios being vacuumed because the television companies have upped and left for the night, or some of them have. It's coming up for 1:15. We've had our 10 o'clock briefing, our 11 o'clock briefing, our midnight briefing, and we've been told to sit tight and wait for the next round of briefings, which could be any time at all, could be 6 o'clock in the morning for all we know. But basically, they all came out, they all briefed us, and they all went back in the room.
So it's 10 to 1 in the morning, and it's been a few press conferences. The G77 plus China haven't done an official press conference, but their head rep, Ambassador Lumumba Diaping, came down the stairs here into the press room The G77 plus China's offices are kind of upstairs here above the press room. Gave a press briefing from towards the foot of the stairs, and with people gathered around him, no microphone, lots of TV cameras and photographers. You could just about hear what he was saying. Wouldn't have been able to record him unless you were right at the front of the scrum. But basically giving a very sober assessment of the deal that everybody's so excited about. He's saying that it's not actually been formally tabled yet. So at the current point, it's a political declaration and it's spin. And G77 will wait until they see the formally tabled document before they make an assessment. But also the plenaries are just about to start, and we'll get to hear in there probably some countries' reactions to this whole storm. Some people seem to be mistaken that there's some kind of deal. If there's any deal done, I guess the major industrialised countries have managed to strong-arm and pick off or do some deal with the BRIC countries, the major emerging economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China. But it's not even clear at this stage who supports this text and who doesn't. It's all a bit word of mouth. It's all a bit Chinese whispers. We're getting conflicting messages. That should clear up during the plenary. So just a few bullets from my notes. Diaping saying there is no deal. And the rich evidently do not accept democracy as the basis of these negotiations. He did say that there were four African countries that appeared to be supporting the American-led text. Lesotho, very tiny country in South Africa. Algeria, which was quite a surprise. South Africa and Ethiopia, we already know that they've moved very close to the rich industrial world over the course of the week. I've just been given a copy of the text. I haven't had a chance to digest it yet, and I know John Vidal's working on that for The Guardian, but by all accounts, it's very weak. It's pretty much what the US was asking for, the kind of lowest common denominator possible. Nothing binding, all kind of aspirational, but I'm falling into everybody else's trap by devoting so much time to it when it's not even a formally tabled text. So I'm here with Deepak Raghani of Biofuel Watch and also a representative of the Climate Justice Now Coalition. Perhaps you can just tell us who Climate Justice Now are.
Well, Climate Justice Now formed really in a response to quite weak position taking on behalf of the main lobbying group called CAN, or the Climate Action Network. And they include quite strong groups like Friends of the Earth International, hundreds of groups, in fact, representing civil society and indigenous groups in the Global South. In fact, almost all nations are represented there.
And wondering what your response is to the informal text that's been dropped in the last hour or so. Because I understand it's not formally been tabled yet. It's not available at the documents desk. And Diaping Lumumba just said that it's we'll consider the text when it's tabled. But there's been a lot of hoo-ha around it, and it's got more attention than any of the other texts on the table. But what do you make of it all?
And I think the strongest statement to make has really come from 100 countries who've stood out and said, actually, this is nowhere near enough of what we should be doing. One of the things they're saying, of course, these are all countries from the developing south, is they're saying that we should have a maximum ceiling of 1.5 degrees centigrade in terms of warming. And they're also saying that if you cross much more than 2 degrees, 2.5 degrees, you don't actually get that. You end up with 6, because tipping points have a cascading effect. You cross one, you cross them all. So that's a very clear piece of science, and I think the Global South coming together and actually making that statement back to the North and quoting back to them their own science is a very powerful statement. On top of that, we've got a situation where these 100 countries are saying that we should be putting aside 5% of the gross national product globally to fight climate change, to impact on adaptation, and to bring mitigation measures into place as quickly as possible. They're also looking for $400 billion annually as a way of providing some of these changes in the Global South. Some of that is for adaptation, some of that is mitigation, some of that is developing societies with true renewable energy. Now, this is an interesting point on its own because the US have said, you know, that we should be starting off with $10 billion. Well, when you think of what the US as a single country have spent bailing out banks, in just 2008 alone, they spent $168 billion and they're offering $10 billion now. Well, that's just derisory. And it puts into perspective the way the US feel about climate change and just how seriously they take it. And you can see that from President Obama's speech this evening. He said a very interesting statement. He said that the US should have a clean slate from now on. In other words, they're entering the negotiations with a clean slate. Well, that's an absolutely outrageous statement to make. Having spent 15 years obfuscating and on occasions completely sabotaging the climate agreement and then being the biggest polluting country throughout those 15 years, I think people in the Global South are understandably outraged. So we're at a situation now where the G77 are almost certainly going to reject the Copenhagen Accord as it stands. The plenary are meeting, the members of the protocol are meeting to actually make a decision country by country, and we'll have the results of that in about an hour.
In terms of the US saying it wishes to have a start with a clean slate, that's pretty much denying its historical responsibility, which is it's kind of written into the UN Framework Convention, isn't it? Responsibility, all that kind of stuff. They're just trying to forget all that all of a sudden.
Yes, it's the term is differentiated responsibility in terms of what we do to clean up the problem. I think it's a slightly different use of the term. But I think one thing that the Global South are actually looking for is an acknowledgement that the North have been the cause of a problem that they are suffering the consequences of right now. We might suffer it in decades to come, but they're facing it now. And not only is there not an acknowledgement, but there isn't even an apology. And I think a statement like we have a clean slate is a red rag to countries who are facing global poverty, floods, and accelerated climate change in terms of desertification.
He's come here basically not to negotiate, it seems to me. He's kind of laid down the law. This is what the US has said it's going to do. You know, take it or leave it. That's pretty much it. It seems to be what they've done, isn't it?
Well, all he said is we're taking the first step, and we're taking the first step together. And then lots of talk about how they're going to involve India and China, and even developing countries have to make their own forward movements as far as climate change is concerned. Well, that's all given as part of the existing protocol, that actually that's what differentiated responsibilities means, that actually the North will do more and the Global South will do something, but less. So there's nothing new there. There's a lot of rhetoric and no deliverables. I think the fact that President Obama left the premises here about 2 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago, by helicopter is indicative of the fact that he's not hanging around expecting there to be some kind of agreement on this. I think it's the first stage, it's the ball rolling. We're now going to spend another year looking at the long-term cooperative action plans, and the Kyoto any post-Kyoto agreement will fall out of that. So I think it's a very clear statement. I think don't hold your breath on any agreement. What the best we can hope for now is that we clear the slate in a different way, not in terms of the US being absolved of any historic emissions, but clear the slate in terms of saying, right, let's start from scratch and create an agreement that really has teeth. Let's get rid of all the false solutions. False solutions like a CDM that's deeply dysfunctional, bioenergy, biofuels masquerading as renewable energy, all this stuff that we know is warming the planet and is actually earning the countries large amounts of money and pretending to bring greenhouse gas emissions down. Let's get rid of that and start again from scratch.
But it represents important elements which we now stand in the grave danger of losing completely. We appeal strongly to those colleagues who disagree with this view to reconsider and to identify clearly the exact points of disagreement and contention so that we can work towards an acceptable compromise in which to move this forward in the most appropriate documentary form next year. In this regard, Mr. President, my delegation appeals to you strongly to quickly and most immediately identify a procedure in which we can find what it is exactly that's wrong.
Yes, that was the sound of someone snoring. It's 6:30 a.m. Nope, sorry, it's 10 to 7. And I am surrounded by sleeping journalists, and still the negotiations are going on. There are 20 more people on the list for this round of of speaking, and I presume there's going to be replies after that. I didn't make it to my hotel tonight. I'm very sad about that because I haven't seen the inside of my hotel and I was really excited about staying there. I have to check out tomorrow because there's no space tomorrow night, and I don't know if it's even worth getting another hotel because nobody's going home from this place. We're here all the time. And these talks don't look like they're finished, not by a long way. Unless something dramatic happens in the next couple of hours, which you never know. It wasn't Phil snoring, but I've just come back to the desk and he is now asleep. Oh.
It's 10:05 in Copenhagen on Saturday, 18th of December, 2009. The UN climate talks were supposed to end yesterday, but they've rolled on throughout the night. The current state of play is that a handful of countries are holding out against the so-called Copenhagen Accord that a group of 30 or so countries convened by the Danish Prime Minister cooked up over a 24-hour period and formally presented to the plenary at the end of yesterday. By that time, media outlets around the world had already proclaimed that a deal had been struck. The BBC, for example, sent out an email bulletin on its breaking news alert list titled "Deal Reached at Climate Summit." At around midnight, the EU acknowledged in their press conference that the proposed deal that they were party to was not strong enough to stay below their 2 degrees target. Neither was it even enough for them to increase their target from 20% to 30%. The talks rumbled on through the night in an open plenary session, and it was an odd twist, I thought, to see country after country line up to support the deal and to condemn Ambassador Lumumba Diaping, chair of the G77 plus China, after he made this statement on behalf of Sudan at 5:30 in the morning.
Mr. Prime Minister, the document L9 of the 18th of December and I'm speaking here on behalf of Sudan, is one of the most disturbing developments in the history of the UNFCCC. This document threatens the lives and the livelihoods of millions of people in developing countries and the existence of the African continent and her people. You have relentlessly and single-mindedly decided to advance through this document with the circle of commitment and those who have agreed, the heads of states and heads of government behind this document, to accept a solution that is based on a 2 degrees Celsius, which will result in gross violation of the right to existence of the African and the African continent. L9 is murderous. It condemns and tunnels Africa into a furnace because 2 degrees Celsius results into 3.5 degrees. According to IPCC AR4 regional report, working group number 2, L9 ask Africa to sign a suicide pact, an incineration pact, in order to maintain the economic dominance of few countries. L9 is devoid of any sense of responsibility, morality, and it is a solution based on values the same very values, in our opinion, that tunneled 6 million people in Europe into furnaces. Mr. Prime Minister, no Obama, or yourself can force Africa to destroy herself. And I want to say this on record. There's nobody, no African president or prime minister has been mandated or given a mandate to destroy or aid and abet in destroying Africa. 2 degrees Celsius is certain death. And as such, we do believe that it's immoral to even think that this product, this document, was issued by a UN or UN-related body. The promise of $100 billion, Mr. Prime Minister, will not bribe us to destroy the continent. As such, Mr. Prime Minister, we do ask you to withdraw L9. Destroy it, delete it from the UNFCCC system completely.
It was heart-sinking to see Decima Williams of Grenada, who has been campaigning strongly for over a year for the right to survival for the peoples of the Association of Small Island States, for a deal based on the latest science of keeping atmospheric CO2 below 350 parts per million, and keeping global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees C, joining the long line of countries who apparently prefer a weak, ineffectual deal to no deal at all. Almost everyone, it seems, has acquiesced to the lowest common denominator offered by rich countries. At around 9 a.m. this morning, the talks were adjourned as Ed Miliband and others pursue their charge to find a way around the blocking of several countries in order to finally force this deal through. But let's be clear, this is a deal that would not be grounded in science and will likely lead to runaway climate change. It kills the Kyoto Protocol and the legally binding commitment it makes on all rich nations except the United States. And although it says that funds of $100 billion per year will be raised, it's not clear how much of this is new money, how much of this is coming from existing development aid budgets. But it is likely that the bulk of it will come from the carbon markets, with all the problems that that implies. How did all the countries who had been fighting for a principled and effective deal based on science and justice come to abandon everything they had fought so long and hard for? Under pressure to break the deadlock of the talks in order to get a deal, poor and vulnerable countries have given away everything, while rich countries have hardly moved an inch, and some of them have moved backwards. Right now, it's not clear how the impasse at these talks will be resolved, or if it will be resolved. But as the social movements outside these talks have been saying long in advance of the talks, citizens will have to continue to take matters into their own hands. to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.